Now we come to the most, every book is the most marvelous in the world, but this is really something. If we get stalled on it for the rest of the semester, it would be worth it. But they're all like this. But this is a particularly important book, and of course I'm referring to that miraculous work, 4th Nephi. It's an epitome. It's a digest. The whole Book of Mormon is there. You don't have to read anything but this one book. You've got the role, so I can't ask you questions. How many chapters does it have?
One.
Does it get it all in there? Yes, it does. It contains the best case and the worst case, and it describes them and it explains them all in one chapter, in one book. It's a marvelous thing. For us, the worst case is easy to imagine, easy to describe. We could all sit down and write very good compositions on the worst possible case for our work. But if it came to the best case, we'd all be stumped. We wouldn't know what to do or what to say. And what does that signify about our place on the scale of excellence in the universe? What does that mean? I mean, I can imagine most vividly, in fact, from personal experience, all the time, I can think about the worst possible case. See, all sorts of things. But then you ask me, what's the best possible case that could happen in the fate of the nation here that we're talking about, the Nephites? Well, of course, this describes it. But for ourselves, we can't imagine it. The reason we're so intimate, of course, is we're so close to the other. If you put it on a scale, say, like the doomsday clock or something like that, we put the worst case down here, the best case up here, we're somewhere down here right now, aren't we? We have a long way to go. So here we have this marvelous book. Now, it's very, very short for the reason that Voltaire explains. Happy are the people whose annals are a blank. If people live happy lives, what are you going to write about them? We've mentioned this before. Without your crime, murder, rape, and so forth, you're not going to have any prime TV. We just have to leave that out. The same thing, is their life empty and boring? This is the question we have to have. Now, life in an Egyptian village, we were out digging among Egyptian villages, life in an Egyptian village and life in a Hopi village are very much alike. They're very stable, thousands of years, no change at all. And when people go away, they come back, they get bored with life anywhere else, and they come back because it's much more exciting. All sorts of pleasant things going on, a very interesting situation. There is an other side to it too, but it's stable and unchanging, and it's unchanging because they're the happiest societies, they don't want to change. But there's a big problem here, you see. What was the advantage? Why wouldn't you live in a Hopi village or an Egyptian village, which are exactly like the villages in the models for 5, 6, and 7,000 years ago? Same village, same people, same donkeys, same crops, same palm trees, same geese, same mud houses built on exactly the same pattern. Thousands of years, in and out, go on and on. Perfectly happy people, they're very happy people. And yet they go to the city still, and the city is hell. Of course, there's no more hideous and marvelous city in the world than Cairo, but they go, why would you go there? What's lacking in that life, you see? Well, of course, the problem is one of boredom. There's more to boredom, it's guilt, you see. What about your capacities? You can go out to the field and work a day and make a living. You can have enough. The soil is extremely rich, and they can go on living. The problem now is population. They're getting so overpopulated. There's not enough. It's getting not enough to go around. It's getting rather desperate everywhere in the world. But aside from that, and it's only happened very recently, you'd feel guilty staying in the village. Why would you feel guilty staying in the village? Why would I feel guilty? Well, remember what Hamlet says. Yes. What is a man if the chief good and market of his time is but to feed and sleep? Sure, he who made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not such capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused. We must use our capacities. You're not going to have a chance to use them all out there. You're going to see what happens here. And so there is, the Greeks cut loose, well, the Egyptians too. The Greeks came to learn from the Egyptians. There's another story here. But the fact is that the greatness of Greece and the Egyptians too, the one is in Sinua and the other is in Odysseus, they may be the same person as far as that goes. But Odysseus says, remember, when he's talking to, you remember, of course, when he's talking to the Phaeacians, he introduces himself, a mother self, Laercades, Hos passandalesin, anthropoisimalokai, mephkleos, anthrum, my fame is known to him. Then he says, Ned's of Ithaca. I live in Ithaca. He's the king of a little rocky island and nothing else. Why didn't he stay home and rule? Why is he traveling all the time? Remember how the Odyssey begins? He goes everywhere and sees everything and suffers everything. He's willing to do it for his curiosity. But he explains, see, it's an island. Treche alagathe, karutravas, utogoga, heskais, glickeres, glickeron, glickerotron, alo adestai, he says. It is a rough and a rocky land, poor soil, but it's great for raising young people, he says. Kurutravas. Utogoga, heskais, I cannot imagine a more happy land for that sort of thing. But then they have to get out and go and find out something. There's more. They get this. Well, after all, if you live in a rocky, unproductive soil and the sea's all around you, and you see other lands, you're going to get moving. This natural curiosity, and this is what makes the Greeks great, uniquely great. Their situation called for it. But this was what would happen. And yet, should we be bored now? As if there were only a limited number of things that we could think about, only a limited number of things that we could combine or do. And we see what the solution is here in the Book of Mormon. The most remarkable document on this is a Mandaean document. I decided to read from it this morning because it's very good. In all the things I have ever read, this is the only description of heaven that anyone dared to describe. The church doctors of the church, it's pitiful. They have no idea how to describe heaven. It's the choir, we'll sing forever, the beatific view of God. You'd look at God for a million years and then that's all you'd want. You'd be completely absorbed in it. Well, it might as well be the heaven as a Buddhist. Might be absorbed in the ocean, the drop of water absorbed in the ocean. They don't know what heaven's going to be like. Hell, they're awfully good on hell. Well, that's the same thing you notice with Dante in the Inferno. He really goes to town. He can give you a detailed blow-by-blow account of everything that goes on there. But when he gets to heaven, you get the ultimate singularity of God as an infinitely tiny point of light with everything revolving around it. But an infinitely tiny point of light that you don't feel particular love or devotion to. That is your father. That is a singularity. But anyway, the Christian fathers couldn't handle it. The Christian churches can't. Nobody else can. But this document does. It's the only thing I've ever read. And it comes from those remarkable people, the Mandaeans. The Mandaeans turn up. They still survive, about 6,000, almost like the Hopis, exactly 6,000 of them. And the Mandaeans. Yeah, right. They're now living in the marshes and in the Shatt al-Arab, where the Tigris and the Euphrates come together. The last 100 miles they run together in vast marshes, and they live on these houses. You may have seen them in the National Geographic, made entirely of reeds. They built temples of reeds, everything of reeds. They live there, but they have these old records. They say, they call themselves the Christians of St. John, not Christians, the Church of St. John, because they're followers of John the Baptist, they say, who left the Jordan when John the Baptist was preaching by the Jordan. They were part of his community. You get this in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And when the others were driven out, they went too. They went north, east, and then south, down the river, and this is where they finally end up. These Mandaeans, because they have the gospel, which the gospel of truth, which they call the Manda Dehaya. Manda is a teaching, you see, Dehaya, of life. This is Mandaean is an Eastern Aramaic dialect. We have their records on plates, very much like the Book of Mormon. You see, they fled and they came way off here and they settled there. And so they're the, what else do they call themselves? They're the Sabaeans. That means Baptists. They're the followers of John the Baptist. They're most known as the Sabaeans. You can spell it with an I or an AE, either one, the Sabaeans. They're the Baptists, and they follow John the Baptist, and they go out there and they live. They're completely, not completely absorbed, but they do very remarkable work in silver and so forth. But their preachings depend very much on the ordinances. They have lots of writings, lots of important writings, and the ordinances, the 112 questions. Lady Drower was responsible for getting some of the plates from them. They're lead plates. You can imagine why lead. Gold is rather expensive, and they're poor people. And any other thing they ride on is going to rot. They live with their feet in the water. After all, they live in the marshes. They live on floating, like Titicaca, on floating villages of reed, marsh. And everything is wet and muggy, and so they keep the records on these lead plates. Well, anyway, we have this remarkable writing. As Paul has said, I'm not going to try to tell you about these things. His eye has not seen, nor ear had not heard, nor has ever entered into the imagination of man the things that God has promised. We can't talk about it because we haven't experienced it. But this I'd like to read to you now because I think it's a wonderful thing. The only persons who ever, they must have had some knowledge to put this down like this. And it starts out, it gives God enthroned in absolute stability in the beautiful city of Zion, where there are no earthly trades, it says. All wear robes of glory. You get a picture now. It begins to get more realistic as you go, though. Robes of glory, girdles of splendor, radiant crowns. All are happy, wise, and gentle, free of any malice or spite or rancor. There is no lie or deceit. There's no fraud. They are clothed upon in glory, dwelling together in perfect oneness with each other. They visit each other, and yet they do not intrude on each other. And nor do they agree in social deceptions, in the tricks of society. Hans Weiger, in the early 20th century, wrote a famous work in its time called Die Philosophie des Als Ob, the philosophy of the as if. Everything we do in our society, the way we get along with each other, the way we grease the wheels and so forth and make things go is an assumption that things are what they aren't, of course. A person signs a letter, you're obedient and humble servant, he's nothing of the sort. But that's the as if. It governs everything. We talk as if politicians were honest. If we didn't act as if, then we'd get nothing done at all, you see. They're crooked as a dog's hind leg, but we must have an as if here, you see, in all things we do. We're here as if we were studying zealously and learning all the things we should. We're not. But if we didn't act as if we did, we'd never be here. We'd never make a beginning at it. So everything is, he says, there's no as if here. Everything is the real thing. He talks about there. They're brilliant in their various firmaments. They are galaxies. Everyone has its particular glory. Well, there's a claw here. They exchange scientific knowledge with each other. And they understand their systems mutually. You see, this is the picture we get in the Book of Moses, too. He talks worlds without number and so forth. He says, they're brilliant in their various firmaments. Everyone has its particular glory, its particular appeal. And they exchange scientific knowledge with each other. And they understand each other's teachings mutually. You understand? And though they are millions and untold millions of parsangs light years apart, you see, we could even say parsecs apart, eh? They are millions of parsangs apart, yet they shine with a common luster. And they breathe a common atmosphere, you might say. Well, that helps things out in solving some of the problems, I suppose, in Star Trek. Problem being, when you land on another planet or moon or something, you can always breathe the air for some reason. But it says that's the way it is. They breathe a common atmosphere and inhale a common odor, it says. And they share the same common truth and understand the same laws of science and of living. So it's not that, of course, we teach that all the time, you see, as has been done in other worlds, as was done in other worlds before this. In other worlds which we have hitherto formed. It's all on the same plan, using the same elements, and it goes on the same way here. Now, what are they going to do, though? They all of the same truth. And they communicate mutually truth, their true sentiments, their true feelings, as well as their doctrines and their logic. You do not conceal your true feelings and emotions from each other, and honest people don't. Death and corruption have no power over them. Of course, that's an important thing. They are ageless and never lose strength. They know no sorrow and suffering. Their flight never wearies and their garments never spot. Their population is optimum and constant. If it's necessary to change, it'll change, you see, up or down as they need, is optimum. They are not the victims of fuzzy thinking, vagueness of thinking, nor are they doubt-ridden in their dealings or in their calculations. Ageless and without physical defects. No conflict, no competition. Why should there be? No slavery, no jealousy, no harmful creatures, no plants or animals that weaken and harm. And of course, it's possible to find islands that don't have. You see, they don't have snakes in Hawaii or in Ireland for that reason. Their various lands are blessed with happy situations like that on this earth, you see. We have patterns for this We have examples of this all over the earth. You can find that such thing is possible. It's conceivable. They bring them all together. Here it is. There are no harmful creatures. There doesn't need to. Now, for example, it always amazes me in Utah. We have no poison oak. You can go out and lie down on the ground and sleep somewhere. I take my kids out. But you can't do that in the South. There are chiggers and fire ants and burrs. Wherever you put down, you can't do it. And the same way with the other harmful creatures here, and poison oak especially. I could never go out anywhere in California without getting poison oak. I was extremely susceptible to it. And that's why I like to be out all the time, and I was always getting, you don't have no poison oak. That's marvelous. Is it possible to have no poison oak? Lived in a house in Berkeley. We had the house in Berkeley when I was teaching there. Completely surrounded. It was an old quarry, and it was a Maybeck house, beautiful house. Completely surrounded. Vast, lush growths of poison oak all around the house. Perfectly natural. But it's worse in the East, in the Harvard Yard. All the hedges in the Harvard Yard, and especially at Princeton, are loaded with poison ivy. And the students all get poison ivy in the spring. When things start getting warm in April and May, everybody blossoms out with rashes and water blisters and everything. It's horrible. So when it says there are worlds in which these things don't exist, you can believe it. There are places here where they don't exist. It's rather nice. And it says, it's very interesting that we're getting ideas of this today. It's going to place great emphasis on environment here because that's important. Heaven is a surrounding. It's a state of mind. It's an environment. You create your environment and it creates you. But it says, all their environments are beautiful and unspoiled, that nature. And yet, their unobtrusive dwellings have magnificent views. Their seas are calm and tranquil. No pirates there. Everything throbs with joy. Their wants are few. They can fly through the air and even visit other worlds. They are so pure that power flows through them without burning them. Of course, that's what the cause of any conveyor of power, of course, what will burn it up and cause trouble is impurities. And when you're so impure, it says that power flows through them without burning them up. We can't risk it. It thrills them and supports them, this power that they can take. What do they do? Fourth Nephi, we're going to get the same thing in Fourth Nephi here. Prayer, study, and meditation. Rigid mental exercises, he says, and praise are their basic exercises. Their company is calm, gay, and utterly delightful, radiating their happiness in common with every form of life. See, that every form of life may fill the measure of its existence and have joy therein. Every form of life. So he says they have joy along with all the other forms of life in nature. They don't intrude on it at all. They're completely individual. No, it's not just a lot of ciphers here. Turned out in the same mold. We're the ones that are that way. Yes, this is a common expression. You understand what it means, but if you analyze it, it's absurd. You know, this is one of those things you get in language. You see? How could you say each more? Here, there were 20 damsels, each more beautiful than the other. Well, how could each be more beautiful than the other? It's impossible. But you know exactly what he means when he says that, you see. When you view this one, you gasp, and the next one, you gasp too, and so forth. And it says the same thing. They're completely individual. Each is more remarkable than the other. Each more illustrious than the other. They lack nothing. Their dwellings are magnificent. All around them is beauty. They can move as fast as thought or as fast as gravity, see. Instant, you can do that. That's what thought can do. That's why you can pray and get instant contact and so forth without any trouble. When they walk, it is with a brisk and easy motion like a ray of light. They live on the treasures of the Jordan. See, they say they came from the Jordan at the time of John the Baptist, and he was their follower. And the fruits of the trees. It seems they're vegetarians, back to Eden again. But the error, and then it talks about the error and confusion of this world makes such things seem impossible. He says, when I describe these, you won't believe them because it's so alien to anything we experience here. So that's impossible. But there we recognize our own potential. He says, we could do it here if we would, you see. And so, from such a world, now he talks about the creation. It was from such a world that the Most High God appointed a deputy to come to this world for the creation. This was Abel Zevo, who is always called Gabriel. See, they can't give the credit to Jesus because they're disciples of John the Baptist. They lived before. And when we say, come to Jesus, come to Christ, what do we mean? It's very obvious what it is, and that's just a sentimental expression. Come to the mourner's bench, come to Jesus. It's come to him to be taught, come to him for instruction. It says here, the Most High God appointed a deputy to this world, calling Gabriel, saying, go down, he's going down to teach. It's going down to the creation here, but the point is, you don't make direct contact with God, as we are here, God being what he is and so forth. We must be instructed first. We must be prepared for it. We must be told what the situation is. We must receive the proper briefings before we can go into the presence of God, and that's what the Lord is for. He's the intercessor. He's come and learn of me, he says. He is a great teacher. He's there to teach us, to prepare us to go into the presence of God. We hear all these things all the time, but we don't realize how absolutely true there are. You can't get into another world and graduate into it with one step. The culture shock would wipe you out just like that. You can't do that. So the Lord prepares the way, and of course there are many mansions, he told us, and all those passages we read from John, remember, and from 3 Nephi, I go to prepare a place for you. I'll come back and I get you when the time is ready, when the place is ready. He comes and he goes, he visits, he talks with me, he goes to one group, he goes with another group, and so it's rather a complicated thing, but it's all being arranged on a very matter-of-fact basis here. And so the Most High God appointed a deputy to this world, and that was Abel's evil. Abel, that's just the word Abel, the son of Adam, who is Abel, Zebo, the eternally living Abel, who is also called Gabriel. He said to him, go down to the world of darkness. He'd go down to the chaos. It's chaos. There is matter there, he says. Go down to the world of darkness where everything is in a process of slow combustion, of entropy, you see. A totally false and counterfeit world until it has been organized, you see, in its present state. A world where everything is wrong. Go down there and check the darkness and get to the bottom of the mysteries of material existence so that we can construct something better of it. Then form and condense an earth of these things. Unroll a firmament above it and fix it there in its proper situation among the other stars and the other systems, he says, in the midst of the other stars and systems. Give them a sun in its splendor, give them a moon in its pale beauty, and so forth. And I've left some out there. Better go back and fill it in, I guess. Cause the earth to bring forth, yes? Oh, excuse me, I thought something here. Cause the earth to bring forth all sorts of plant and animal life to give variety and beauty to the scene. There again, mountains and hills, great rivers and small scenes to give variety and beauty. The first concern of God was to give variety and beauty to the earth, you see, when he started forming it. It's meant that way on purpose. We're not supposed to destroy it. It comes first. And the same thing, the trees, that man might look upon it, you see, the beauty thereof, the life of man. And create the animals and the beasts and the fishes and all flying things, all manner of flying things, what it says here, male and female, each after its kind, to serve Adam and all its race. And actually, the ecosystem, with all its animals, wild and otherwise, we now know, fit together indispensably in a controlled system, which serves man. If we start breaking that system down, if we start destroying trees, we say they have nothing to do with us, they live way out there, and we're going to get ourselves into trouble. So they are all created to serve man, to serve each other, too. But they're there for our purpose. The Lord has told us already the basic principle of ecology. These things are there to serve us. Don't destroy them. Use them wisely as we should. So, then finally, when this is done, create a man and a woman. Accordingly, the angel Gabriel came down, spread out the heavens, condensed the earth. Adam and Eve were created, and then their spirits came to animate their bodies. Then he sent down, and then the Lord says to him, go down again to the earth and take your two companions with you. So the three are sent down to teach Adam. Take the two companions. And give man his instructions and instruct Adam in all things. Teach him that, this is very interesting, what he's supposed to do in being here. Teaching that his heart must expand, that his intelligence must grow, that his mind must be illuminated. See, he's out here to have an experience, to be aware of things. He's not here to eat and sleep and exercise and all that sort of thing. That's necessary in this way. That's not the object, is it? We move beyond this. We come down here for this greatest of all exercises. It's going to give us plenty to do. That his intelligence will illuminate itself. And teach him, instruct him, along with the two angels that accompany you, converse familiarly with him on a perfectly equal footing, that he will understand what you're talking about, you understand him. Warn Adam and Eve to be on guard against the tricks of Satan. He has a plan too. Teach them prayers and hymns, again, 4th Nephi, for their defense. Teach them prayers and hymns. Command them to be merry and be fruitful. Give them the law of chastity. Teach them to be peaceful and faithful. Above all, they must avoid Satan's big pitch. They must not desire gold nor silver nor the riches of this world. They are not to worship idols or images of anything in this world. I don't know. It's a long thing. I should copy it further, but go down and complete it. I think that's a remarkable document coming out of the very early, probably from the first to second centuries A.D., very early. These people must really have thought things out to get it as good as that. They got your best science fiction in there. Well, now let's go on with the first verse of 4th Nephi here. Yes.
Did that originate with these people?
They brought it with them. No, they brought it with them. Yeah. It was the doctrine they brought with them. You see, they didn't originate it there. They said, this is what John taught them. John the Baptist taught them. Abel Zevah on earth. John the Baptist came down as Abel. They take the places of each other. Now let's see what we have here. So now, civilization is the things that surround us, we know here. Are we going to see something else here? And as it advances, this is a very interesting thing, as it advances, these things become more and more expendable, not more and more necessary or more and more numerous. If you go back to the 1840s in America, people were surrounded by an unbelievable clutter of things that were not needed. They've disappeared now, but if you go through the ads of old papers and so forth, you find that they had all sorts of toilet articles and items of dress and so forth that turned out to be of no worth whatever. You notice, as a machine becomes more and more perfect, it becomes more and more expendable. It used to be to get across the ocean, you had to have an enormous 80,000-ton ocean greyhound or liner. It used to be you had to have a railroad system, a massive railroad system. Reduce that to planes and get smaller and smaller things. They get smaller and smaller, less and less necessary. It used to be that we'd have these enormous Victorian meals, the Edwardian meals. The board was groaning with every kind of it's as bad as McDonald's for the cholesterol. But they ate themselves to death, and all these things were unnecessary. As they become more civilized, they become more simple and more austere, and so we mentioned before, the great civilizations, you have one standard dress that you do in heaven, or as Pythagorean society. The brotherhoods, remember, live that kind of life, and it's a very austere and simple life. And what the fourth Nephi actually is a utopian. I've written a bit on utopias. But this is the perfect state. How it would be, is it possible? These utopias were speculative writings. You know the great ones, the four great utopias. But we get on here. Do you find when you're engaged in a fascinating project that it helps to be quarreling or have threats or plots or danger or rivalry or bitter competition? Does that help your work at all? Why can't we do away with those? It's unthinkable for us to do away with those. That's a strange thing. And why do we find life boring without an adversary? Well then, who or what puts into our minds that we have to spoil things, that we have to contend and all that sort of thing? The business must be a rat race, a dog-eat-dog world. It subsides into that inevitably every time we start doing things our way. Should it be that way? Well, let's get to the second verse now. Every man dealt just... Well, this covers a lot of ground, you see. The people were all converted, both Nephites and Lamanites, no contentions, disputations, every man to deal justly one with another. Isn't that being a bit idealistic? Is that utopian yet? Suppose if you... Justice is time, the word of the Greeks use, the one we get from Plato, the four Platonic virtues. The first is justice, which is time. It is time. Well, dechomai. Time is to take what is due you, to give everything that is due from you, and to take what is due to you. If you give less than you should, then you're a micropsychos, you're small-minded. Aristotle in the fourth book of the Nicomachean Ethics talks about this. Then you're small-minded and petty. You're confining yourself if you give less than you should. If you take less than you should, if you take less than you do, you're also being petty-minded. You're also being small and petty and cautious, and you think you're being virtuous in being like Scrooge and being abstemious, and the billionaire who goes to work taking his lunch in a brown paper bag and things like that. We admire that man's abstemiousness. Well, what is all his money? You see, he's not a He's a very mean-spirited person, that's what Scrooge does. But it says there, every man to deal justly one with another. And so we have, is this more satisfying to deal justly? Is that means they had relationships, they had deals, they had bargains and so forth. Because you didn't try to take the advantage if you dealt justly. Is this more emotionally satisfying though than charity? If everything is just charity, charity comes all. Do you give the charity and that's all? Charity is the higher law. As the Arabs say, the brave man never asks the odds. The generous man never asks the price. The good man never asks questions. You just go along with that. But what about this bargaining business? Well, that's all right in its realm. Willard Marriott, he wrote a thing on, he gave an interview on the four secrets of success. The first one, he says, is drive a hard bargain. Well, now, is that a good thing? Yes, it is if you're playing with a person who also drives a hard bargain. He says that himself, you see. He says, if you drive a hard bargain, the other guy will respect you because you're playing a game. It's done in the approved spirit of gamesmanship. He's an able opponent. He understands how you're playing and you understand his motive. But you mustn't force others to play that game that aren't as well equipped for that. Can you do that? See, what Satan wants to do is to force everybody to play that game, as Isaiah said. He who turneth away from evil maketh himself a prey. If you won't play the game, you'll become a victim. And of course, they'll pluck you if you don't. And this is what happens. This is the way we do it. You're forced to play the game by your rules. Must you do that? Or a game fitted for your physique? Should I be forced to play basketball? I've been very good at it. And wherever the idea that we must all play the same game, rich or poor, weak or strong, everything, everybody out playing the same game to benefit those that play it more efficiently, the others and so forth, the starving peasant and the mill hand or the mine worker coughing his lungs out, this sort of thing, it's no game for them. The young people who are forced to accept substandard wages. The assumption is that the 300-pounder is fighting a 100-pounder and says, you do this thing by way, don't you? Aren't you sporting about these things and so forth? So the stock market's all right as a casino if you accept these blue chips for what they're worth, nothing, just as chips, just as tokens, and this sort of thing. Let's take the third verse here. They had all things in common among them. This is the stinger, you see. Therefore, they were not rich and poor, bond and free, but they were all made free and partakers of the heavenly gift. The late Malcolm Forbes, you may have noticed, he had a $2 million birthday party a few months ago, and now he's dead. And he used to say, nothing makes free like bucks in the bank. He was careful not to invite anyone to his birthday party. He wasn't either very rich or very famous. That's me, quote, of course, you see, that's small-headed. And in the same way, Cain said, I am free, his flocks fall into my hands. He wasn't ashamed of what he was done. And God said, well, what about Abel? Well, he wouldn't play the game. He says, he was perfectly free, I'm not his keeper, and so forth. Well, then what do we do here? Everyone is healthy and happy. What do they have to do now? Their continued peace in the land. See, they're neither rich nor poor. Today we are compounding both poverty and wealth. Today they're moving farther apart, as you know, and each is becoming greater. Poverty is increasing as wealth is increasing. So here we're going to have some very helpful hints here. In the 37th year passed away and continued peace in the land. And this is what happened. Now, this is an interesting thing here because it's referred to another number of times. And there were great and marvelous works wrought by the disciples of Jesus. Now, always throughout this whole book, whole chapter, there are the disciples of Jesus as special people. The whole society accepts the gospel and so forth and so on, but there are certain who have very special powers, marvelous powers of doing miracles and so forth. They're the ones who are progressing, you see. They're the ones who've got beyond this. It just gives us a hint and tells us they were there and doing certain things. They remind us of the ancient brotherhoods. Notice what it says here. Wrought by the disciples of Christ, insomuch they did heal the sick and raise the dead and cause the lame to walk and the blind to receive their sight and the deaf to hear. And all manner of miracles did they work among the children of men, and nothing did they work miracles save it were in the name of Jesus. These gifts are all for solving problems, you know, and all for solving problems beyond our skill. They went beyond that. And then the fourth verse here, we're going to see that they go beyond this, these brethren. Because later on, you see, when in the whole society, they stand apart as a different group. You've always had them, this particular group of saints. And so the years pass away in the sixth verse, and the Lord prospers them, then they did build cities again. Now, here we have another interesting question. Well, prosper is a good word here. Prosper is a favorite word of the rich. John D. Rockefeller always used to use that word. When one of his crooked deals was successful, he says, we were prospered. The Lord prospered us, y'all. He gave the Lord credit for it, but we were prospered. But here the word prosper is used for a society in which there are no rich. Apparently you can prosper as society, as a group. Brigham Young used to say that, you know. I could make these people the richest people on earth, but we have to be rich as a people. As soon as we start being rich as individuals that way, then that will spoil everything. Then the next verse we read that it was an urban civilization. Now, wait a minute, what about the Garden of Eden? Zarahemla to be built again, many cities had been sunk and so forth. They rebuilt their cities. And it was an urban civilization. So the question arises, which do you prefer, Eden or the Garden of Eden, you see, is the way things should be. That's paradise. That's the paradisical order to which the earth is to return. That's our article of faith. 10th article of faith says we're going back to that. The earth will be renewed and received its paradisical order by living in Eden. But what about the city? What about the ultimate? It's the city of Zion. Zion is very much a city, very much a community. They're of all one heart and one mind. Had no poor among them. And so he called his people Zion. They were a city, a walled city, a city for protection, city of light and so forth. How do you have the two? Well, of course, you combine them both this way. The Lord came and talked with Adam in the garden, but he also visits. He is in the center. You can always call on him in his office in Zion, as far as that goes. But here we have this, the urban civilization, which is the heavenly city. We talk about the heavenly city, the heavenly Jerusalem and so forth. And yet we have the other one. Well, you know, we combine the two very nicely, as far as that goes. The lords of the earth, when after they've made their great deals in real estate, what do? They go out and buy themselves as far away as they can get from the city life they've created, because our city life is becoming pretty vile with our inner cities being what they are. Everybody's trying to escape, and they're trying to capitalize and, of course, make profit on the wilderness. Wilderness is the thing that's a premium now, if you can get that. You see, they realize the only happy life is there, and so they're never content with those things. Yes, the lords of the earth choose some isolated, fair part of the world for discussing their problems. Whether you have a think tank or a convention, they'll go up to the Sierras, or they'll go to Alaska or somewhere for the oil business to hold a conclave and discuss their great matters. Even the military will meet in the pleasantest of surroundings to get near to nature. Strange thing. Now here, I don't think this. Now we come to this very interesting verse, this next one here, this 10th verse. Skip around here. They became an exceedingly fair and delightsome people. That's important too. Did that mean that they had to have perfect bodies and were always aware of that fact? Not a bit of it. The word fair, fager, means what is fair is a thing is as it should be. When a thing is fair, it is as it should be. You talk about fair play, a fair game, a fair proposition, a fairly good way of doing it, a properly good way of doing it, and so forth. A fairly good job. A damsel is fair if her features are in the right place and she has the right measurements, we say. That's not necessarily the same measurements we accept today, but to be fair is the way we imagine it should be. This is the way St. Augustine picks it up from Plato, for example. But Plato himself says, of course, the fair is the kalos kagathos. Kalos is right, proper, every way it should be. Kagathos is good, to be fair and good. And of course, it's aesthetically pleasing as well. In the Euthydemus, he says a golden bowl can be as ugly as a dung basket is beautiful. The dung basket, simply designed, functional, and so forth, can be a beautiful object. Where a golden bowl with all sorts of fancy Victorian frills and gewgaws on it can be absolutely hideous. It's not that thing. It's the function. It's the rightness of it. When you look at a thing, you know that's right. And of course, this is the Platonic doctrine of anamnesis, which we will not pursue here. To be fair and delightsome, to be delightsome, and delightsome, delight is enjoyment without lust. See, that's the difference. It's a great thing here. This, again, is a Platonic idea, isn't it? Your feeling toward nature, you are drawn toward what is lovable, what is endearing, what is rightly proportioned, what is pleasing, what is beautiful, what you've been looking for, what delights you, you see. And with no desire to ravage and exploit, and lust, vandalism, power, gain, notice the four things in the Book of Mormon, power, gain, praise, recognition, and lusts of the flesh. They have nothing to do with delightsome, with delight, or nothing to do with fair. Fair means things are as they should be, and delightsome would mean causing and giving enjoyment without lust of any kind. But in our society, you must control and possess and master a thing, and that is it. That's what Satan wants. See, this is what Satan does. Why do we do it? It's very interesting. A popular theme today, with even with little children, is master of the universe. The theme, you know, I guess we pick it up from some of the space TV shows. These subtle powers, the master, the one who wants to master the universe. He's always turning up at various places and so forth. But this power that the good and the bad, they're equally vicious because each one's after the same thing. Each is out to destroy the other. The other is wicked because he's trying to destroy me. I'm good because I'm trying to destroy him. He takes the same point of view. But these toys they sell at the DCMI and so forth, you get these two monsters with names. The one is red, white, and blue, and the other is black or something like that. And they slug it out for the rule of the universe. Well, such a morbid scenario to be taken seriously by 5 and 6-year-olds is quite something. I hear they stopped those toys at DCMI, but I don't know. They still paid Dungeons and Dragons, robber barons, and so forth. Sheer power, you see. The glory of power, as the great Henry Kissinger says, power is the best aphrodisiac, and it's what he wanted it for, and he wanted plenty. So we fulfill the law of entropy with a vengeance. Modern civilization is working on a vast landfill. That's what we're producing. The city of Cairo is a vast landfill. At all times, in all weather, at all times, no matter where you are, you can stand on the balcony of a hotel 25 feet high, as far as that goes. You smell burning garbage at all times. It's just constantly, that's what we're doing. We're producing garbage in Cairo, burning garbage, the characteristic smell of the city. It's a question. We haven't decided what to do with ours yet. So, what about the next verse? Now, the next verse says, they were married and given in marriage and were blessed according to the multitude of promises which the Lord had made to them. These things had been promised. God knows what we really, will really make us happy. He would promise us that. There's a famous Arabic cycle of stories called the Khadir legends. Khadir was the green man. He was the angel. He was a water sprite, quite a figure. But people go around wishing for things that they shouldn't have. And Khadir, terrible things happen to people. And they say, why is this? Why is this? And then Khadir comes around and explains, if this hadn't been so, this would have been worse for you. You don't know what you really need after all. So Khadir is always telling you, in this case, the Lord knows what would make us happy and what's good for us. But we have the three wish motives, Solomon says. Remember, we have our wishes. We never wish for the right things. It's famous folk tale. You get it in all folk tales where the man is given three wishes by the fairy, and he says, well, I wish I had a nice sausage. This example, the Dutch story. His wife in Petrus, he said, so he had a sausage. His wife said, I wish it was on the end of your nose. So it was on the end of his nose. So the only wish, the third wish, was just to get it off. And had no wishes left. This is what we do. We wish for the wrong things, and we end up holding nothing at all. Solon has some very nice verses on that. Now, the Nephites trusted God to know what was good for them. Ill-gotten gain, we think that is not gain at all here. What they should have, not what we want. You all know the story of the pardoner's tale from Chaucer. Ill-gotten gain, but everybody overreaches everybody else. The three thieves, they pulled off a job, and they were going to celebrate under a tree, and they sent the youngest one off to get some wine from the village that was nearby. And while he was away, they plotted to kill him so they could share the treasure among themselves, not to bother about him. So when he came back, they killed him, and then they drank the wine to celebrate. But meantime, he'd poisoned the wine, so there was the end of the story. You see. They were all out. Chaucer tells us that in the Pardoner's Tale. Well, then what do we have here? Here is the Yes. They did not walk anymore in performance of the law of Moses. They continue. Now, here's what they were doing. They're actually engaged in this. They had to work on it, but their life wasn't dull here. They conceived in fasting and prayer and meeting together, both oft to pray and hear the word of the Lord. Again, we must get an idea of what this word fasting means. It's a very old English word. Fasting is to, well, I wrote down the dictionary meaning. I'm in the back of one of these. I can tell you easy enough what it is. Oh, here it is. How did it get way over here? Oh, yes, because they do no more. They gave up fasting because it was too hard. Oh, this is another thing. But fasting is also. Fasting is also. Fast is the same word as feast, same word as fest, same word as festival, same word as fasti in Latin. It means to hold fast, to hold fast to something, to observe something carefully. But it means to exercise self-control. Fasting means to hold yourself back. That's what it really is. Fasting is the correct, to correct excesses. It's to hold firm. It is self-control. That's the dictionary definition of it. And then it branches off into other things, you see. Fasting is self-restraint. They forewent the pleasures of eating when they weren't hungry. They gave up the pleasure of drinking when they weren't thirsty. That's fasting, you see, because we don't do that. America is all overweight. You know, the great curse of our time is overweight. The main thing we're suffering from, everybody's overweight. So we've been eating when we weren't really hungry. Or we may have been still hungry, but we didn't stop when we should. This is when you fast is self-control. Doesn't mean you starve yourself to death. Become so weak you topple over. That's not fasting, that's excess too, as far as that goes. Then you are losing control just as well. But what are the advantages of fasting? Well, it's more pleasurable. Our number one problem, I say, is overweight. Brigham Young has something to say on that. He says, we all eat too much, we wear too much, we work too much. And that was in those times when they did. If we all ate less, wore less, and worked less, we'd be a better, happier, and wiser people. When I said that to Ernest Wilkinson, he went through the scene. But he thought we couldn't work enough or become too rich or anything like that. But we used to have some nice go-tos with each other. He put up with me, you see, because, I knew he was a liar and he believed in adversarial things. Most people were intimidated by him, but he was one of the few men around that was smarter than I, so we got on fire. The basic question. So we get our number one problems. Now, the child cannot resist all the candy. If you give him more, he wants to go on eating it. Beyond a certain point, we have to tell the child he's got to start fasting. Well, the ninth candy bar is going to make him sick, but he'll eat it just as sure as anything, you say. Wouldn't fasting be better for him? Wouldn't the restraint be better for him? See, fasting is to keep yourself within bounds. Remember what the Lord tells us? Appetites, desires, and passions must be kept within the bounds the Lord has set. It means any kind of appetites like that. In other words, and the only way you keep them in bounds is by fasting. The Book of Mormon tells us later on, you must withhold yourself from certain activities which you might find pleasurable for the time being. And perfectly natural as far as that goes, but you must deny yourself, so you must cross yourself. It's perfectly natural to want to eat until you bust, but you must deny yourself. We must fast. So this was necessary to preserving this order of society and to bringing it about. We're nearly up here. Oh, we're already 12 verse. So, continuing in prayer, prayer of both kinds, are the two kinds. When you put your God? Yes, the one is when you put what you really want and what you really feel into words. That's your very personal prayer and so forth. To be sincere, it must avoid mechanical repetition, like a prayer wheel. And yet, if our wants are few, you'll naturally have to do a lot of repeating there. You just want a few things. So we have the Lord's Prayer, you see. Give us this day our daily bread. And this is in the Book of Mormon, too. And then the very next thing, thy kingdom come. It's strange that people have commented on the absurdity of that, such as famous author talked about the... Why does he say, this is what he says, this is Conrad I'm talking about, Joseph Conrad, give us this day our daily bread. He says, thy kingdom come on earth as it is, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Great things, great thoughts, then suddenly starts coming down to the economy. Give us this day our daily bread. Well, that's the big obstacle to this, you see. The big obstacle, as soon as you have to depend on somebody else for your daily bread, that's not the kingdom of God. That's not things where things are done equitably. That's where the stumbling block is. And forgive our debts, and Book of Mormon says debts using the business term, as we forgive those who owe us, our debts as we forgive our debtors. Now, that's the obstacle to the kingdom of heaven, so that comes next. The Lord's going to take that out. And it's the same thing here. Our wants are few. What are we going to ask for? It requires intense introspection, see. Where do I go from here is what you ask every time you pray to the Lord personally, see. Where do I go from here? Is there anything I need? What I haven't done, you find out there's plenty to do. You can't stand still. And the other is the continuing prayer. He says they prayed continuously. Schleiermacher talks about that. That's the mutual awareness. That's they prayed together, raised both meeting together to pray and hear the word of the Lord. Fasting and prayer, your personal prayer, and you meet together. And that's the continuing prayer. Well, we haven't got that here. Of course, we can't get stuck on the shortest book in the Book of Mormon, but it covers so much ground and has so much of the other in it. We might. Hey, did that roll get around? I hope it did.